It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, there's free fishing on many lakes in the state this weekend. An ice fishing expert will give us some advice and encouragement to give it a try.
First, the lawsuit filed by 17 states to block President Obama's immigration plan is being heard today in Texas. Texas is leading the suit, and 16 other Republican-controlled states have signed on as well, including Wisconsin.
The states involved say that the president is violating his constitutional duty to enforce the laws and is illegally placing new burdens on state budgets.
This week, a dozen other states filed a brief supporting the president's immigration plan, saying that the plan keeps families together and helps their economies. Here with us to talk about the case is political science professor Howard Schwaber of UW-Madison. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, which parts of the president's plan are being challenged?
Well, that gets a little complicated. There are two distinct parts to the president's executive order or his plan here, and then there's actually a third issue. So the two parts of the plan are first to refrain from deporting Dreamers and other illegal immigrants who fall into specific categories. The president was very careful to make sure that people who have been convicted of crimes, for example, are still subject to deportation, but he used his claim of executive discretion to declare that a very large number, several million, up to 4.7 million illegal immigrants, would not be subject to deportation. Second, the president's plan also extends certain benefits to these illegal immigrants, and that's a separate item with separate constitutional issues. And those are the two parts of the plan. The third issue that's being raised by the states is that, in practice, the consequence of this plan is to impose new costs on state governments, which are obliged to provide certain continue providing certain benefits, and that is independently a constitutional issue.
In terms of precedents, are there other precedents of states challenging executive actions like this?
There are, and really the three pieces that I just described each fall into a separate, pretty well-established, although not necessarily clear, constitutional category. So the first one is in some ways the easiest. Does the president have the authority to order Homeland Security to refrain from deporting a certain category of people? And the obvious answer is yes. Obvious in the sense that there's a lot of precedent that says the executive branch has almost unfettered discretion in determining how to enforce the law, and even whether to enforce the law, at least on a case-by-case basis. Now, the states filing this lawsuit claim that this is an unusual situation because this isn't an exercise of executive discretion on a case-by-case basis. It's on a broad categorical kind of basis. But that's not really a sharp distinction. There are also at least three other legal theories that would support the president's action as far as suspension of deportation goes. One is that the law explicitly gives the executive branch the authority to set priorities, and that seems to support, you know, even a broader grant of executive discretion. Secondly, there's a lot of precedent for the idea of de facto delegation of authority, that is, Congress has acquiesced in the past to executive exercising this kind of discretion. And third, the Congress has consistently funded these enforcement efforts at such a low level that the executive branch has had no choice but to make priority decisions. And there's only funding to proceed with deportation proceedings against a small fraction of the total, then by definition some choices are going to have to be made as to what groups will or will not be targeted. So the Obama administration is probably on its strongest constitutional ground, certainly based on existing precedent, in the decision not to deport. But it gets a little trickier when you get to the question of extending benefits. And that brings us to a really interesting case from way back in 1973 that no one's talking about, but really we should be talking about. So way back in 1973, under the Nixon administration, the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare systematically refrained from enforcing the Civil Rights Act. They were under federal law, HEW was not supposed to allow schools that were not desegregating to receive federal funds, but quite systematically, they were deliberately sending federal funds to segregated schools despite complete noncompliance. And when that was brought to the attention of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, that court sitting en banc, that is all the judges from the whole circuit, got together and wrote a pretty stinging opinion that says this goes way beyond executive discretion. This is the executive deliberately undermining Congress's purposes and refusing to carry out the policy. And furthermore, this, they said, is different from an ordinary instance of executive discretion because the government is affirmatively giving money and benefits to these people. So there's a kind of an interesting and ironic parallel here, that the one case, at least that I'm aware of, that strongly stands for the proposition that there are limits to executive discretion when those when the exercise of that discretion would undermine Congress's purposes, and that those limits kick in with special force when the government is not only failing to punish people or deport them or imprison them or whatever, but is actually providing benefits. The one case that really strengthens those two arguments is, ironically, a case brought on behalf of racial minorities challenging the Nixon administration's refusal to enforce desegregation laws.
So there's a lot to look at there. Maybe that that first case you talked about will come up as this case progresses. Let's look at the third point there, that the executive action is imposing new costs to the state. How does that fare in court?
That one is quite weak. There are circumstances, at least in my view, there are circumstances in which the federal government imposing costs on the states can become a problem. And the most obvious is what we call unfunded mandates. So if Congress passes a law saying all states must provide, I don't know, a free car to every citizen, but won't provide any federal dollars to carry out that goal, that's an unfunded mandate. And there are limits on how Congress can do that. And there are also limits on the ways in which Congress can use the states to carry out federal law. Now, you notice I keep saying Congress. Here we have the odd situation where the burden on the states is by an executive order issued by the president, not by an act of Congress at all. There really, though, isn't much precedent for the idea that the fact that a federal action, regardless of which branch is acting, has the effect of creating some circumstance that's going to cost the states money. There's not really much precedent for the idea that that mere effect raises a constitutional issue. After all, there are all kinds of contexts in which the states have to expend money. And as I pointed out earlier, Congress has not allocated nearly enough money to deport all illegal aliens. So by definition, Congress has left the states carrying some of those costs.
Well, speaking of costs, when you've got a multi-state lawsuit like this against the federal government from the states, who's paying for it?
The taxpayers. And this is likely to become quite expensive. I'm quite sure this will cost millions of dollars before it's over. I should point out that in all the comments I've made so far are based on the precedents that are already on the books. The U.S. Supreme Court can always, once this case reaches them, make a new rule. And this is sometimes how new rules happen. So there's a long-standing precedent for executive discretion, but perhaps this exercise of executive discretion looks different from the others, bigger, more sweeping, more clearly contrary to the will of Congress. And this could be one of those cases that produces a new rule and a new defining principle. As things stand right now, though, the decision to refrain from deporting and the incidental imposition of costs, those are pretty weak claims. But now, the decision to extend benefits, that might have some teeth.
As we look ahead about how this might progress, do you think it's likely that this could end up before the U.S. Supreme Court?
I think it's almost certain to do so. Because obviously no matter which side loses, they're going to appeal. And this is the kind of question about the relations between the branches of government that the Supreme Court really exists to resolve. I mean that both sort of historically and philosophically. The idea of separation of powers is in part that one branch can act as a referee when the other two are at loggerheads. And here you have a direct conflict over the question, what are the limits the Constitution imposes on the sharing or distribution of powers between the branches? And that's an area in which the Supreme Court has always asserted its supremacy and its sole authority to make final determinations.
Now, the first part of this case is being heard in Texas. Do you have any indication about how the judge there could rule?
Yeah, there is some indication that the judge in question is quite conservative. He's a Republican appointee, and the expectation is that he might very well rule against the Obama administration, if only to make a point. Again, in this first round of litigation, everyone involved, including the judge, knows full well that there's going to be more. It's going to go on to at least a court of appeals. And so there's a certain amount of posturing going on. It will be interesting to see what legal arguments the judge relies on and how far he's willing to go. In terms of pushing the principles. But as I say, there is at least an arguable precedent out there for the idea that while executive discretion is a privilege of the executive branch, it may reach a limit when it's directly undermining the purposes of Congress. That was true in 1973. It's not impossible that courts will find that is true again today.
And in terms of Wisconsin and Wisconsin's stake in this, what does the Walker administration feel is at stake for Wisconsin?
That's a good question. I think to a very large extent, the Walker administration is really just trying to position, well, Scott Walker is trying to position himself politically. He wants to be, we all suspect that he wants to run for president. Whether that's true or not, within the Republican Party, he wants to position himself appropriately on the question of immigration, which one is one of the defining issues for the Republican Party at this time. Wisconsin does have some direct financial stake here. There are undocumented aliens in Wisconsin, but surely not nearly as many as in states like Texas and Arizona and Louisiana or even Missouri.
Well, Howard, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's my pleasure.
We've been speaking with political science professor Howard Schwaber from UW-Madison about the lawsuit against the president's immigration plan being heard today in Texas. It was filed by 17 states, including Wisconsin.